Welcome. I think we're going to get started just so you guys can get to dinner in the second wave. My name is Wendy and I serve the Village as Education Associate. I've been here with my family for about a month. And I feel really honored to welcome Dr. Paul Lee here to talk about myths of the Reformation. Has it been 38 years since he last visited? Something like that. Or when he was 38. He wasn't sure.
He was 12,
yes, because we decided he's younger than me. I think especially with the 500th anniversary coming up of the Reformation, we're really excited to have you talking. It is a recorded session, so the conversation is also recorded and will be available on the Holden Audio Archive. So we look forward to your teaching and welcome and thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Boy, did I need that nap. What a strenuous morning. Both Karens there cracking the whip. So we got most of that wall built. Ooh. And tomorrow's another day. We'll be up and ready to continue. Thinking of... As we were building the wall this morning, I thought about Martin Luther, who really grew up in the copper mining industry. His father was, of course, the owner of a mine, but he had to relate to the local community there in Mansfeld in Germany. And his father wanted him to become a lawyer so he could maybe negotiate a little bit more with the workers of the copper mine. And some of you probably know, when Luther died, he was on a mission back to the copper country to negotiate with the miners some dispute that they had. So when you get to a place like Holden Village, with the Rio Tinto here, you feel that this is a sort of an atmosphere that Luther would have appreciated when he was growing up as a young boy, and where he died in the very same area. I was looking at this verse that we have from Ecclesiastes. You know, for everything there is a time, there is a season. I mean, Luther, of course, looked at that verse as part of the more tragic side of the biblical message. That ends, of course, there is nothing new under the sun. But he says, to that you must add Isaiah and Jeremiah, Ezekiel, the prophets, the whole New Testament, and the proclamation of the new being, the new community, the new creation in Jesus Christ. But these two have to be held together. And Luther was always looking at the creation, the forests and the trees, as what he called the larva dei, the masks of God. These are masks of God. And he saw this in terms of the dynamic of death and resurrection, of cross and new life. God doesn't cause the Wolverine fire, of course, but the question is, can you see, do you have eyes to see in what is happening in nature? Something beyond that. Can you see through that? This is a mask. These are the symbols, the broken symbols through which you have to discern something about your own life. And most of life is something that has to do with death and with new life. And this was the major theme of Luther's theology of the cross. As someone who has been involved in conflict resolution in a number of countries, you come to see this dynamic also. Out of alienation, how can you bring reconciliation? Out of despair, how can you bring hope? Out of war in El Salvador, Guatemala, Namibia, or in Africa, where I've worked mainly, in Nigeria, how can this horrible situation, something new be created? And you come to the conclusion, and I'm trying to look at it just empirically, not as a theologian, that there's always this element of dying that's part of it. It's an element of vulnerability. It's like when a couple argues, you know, it's only when that vicious circle is broken, when one of them is willing to say, hey dear, I really messed up. I messed up. Well, it's the same thing with conflicts on all different levels. So, I mean, this is not what I'm called to talk about today, but I had to mention the fact that looking out over the burned timber of the forest and listening to Peg talk yesterday, you can't help but think that Martin Luther would have also really been there to say, what is the dynamic to which these signs point? And his role, as he said it, was so that people would have eyes to see things that they didn't see before, ears to hear. Are we really listening? Are we really hearing to what God is saying to us, both through the natural world and through the world of history? We're happy to be back in Holden after, 38 years? You know, you listen to those old tapes that when you gave talks 38 years ago, I did, I clicked on one here last week. That is a very humbling experience. You know, listen to yourself, what you're saying about this and that. And not so much the subject matter, but about how you say things and your non-inclusive language that you use. You know, we've all grown a little bit, and when you listen to the old tapes from Holden, it makes you realize that you've had to grow in the years since. As you know, it's the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, that day when the Augustinian monk Martin Luther nailed 95 theses on the door of the church, Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany, theses for debate, and set off a movement, of course, that changed Western society, that changed the world, you could say. We all know this. We're going to celebrate it next year in all different ways, certainly in Wittenberg, but all around in the world. Anybody been to Wittenberg? Wittenberg, oh, great. And you know it's mainly that one street. At one end you have the castle church. Then you come down a little closer to the middle of town, there is the Lukas Cranach Printing Company, Lukas Cranach being one of the great painters of the Reformation. Then you have the village square, the marketplace, statue of Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon. Then you have the town church right in the middle. That's where Luther preached. That's where his good friend Johannes Bugenhagen was the pastor, the one who brought the word of the Reformation to much of Scandinavia. They were good friends. Bugenhagen was the sort of counselor to Martin Luther, who listened to all of his anguishes and heard confession from him, but it was also a very good friend. Then at the other end, you have the Luther House, the old Augustinian, the Black Monastery, they called it, In the middle, of course, you have the University of Wittenberg, the Leucaria, they called it in Latin. But it's worth a trip. Go and make that little pilgrimage, and in that Luther house, you will find something about Luther that is not so well known. Last time I was there, I took a picture of it, and I brought it here. You can just take a look at it. And that is represented by this particular just thing. We're finding something that will be our object lesson for today. By the way, you can object or raise your hand or say this or that. I don't quite get that. But this is a story that is not commonly told. I call it the forgotten Luther. The Luther that nobody knows. But a story that created a revolution that swept throughout Western Europe, northern to Scandinavia, and is very much alive today. One of the myth in the negative sense of the Reformation was that people saw it only as God's word of grace and individual freedom for me, for my life. And this is justification by grace through faith. But for Luther, of course, that had a vast social dimension also. Once you say that grace is for everybody, you create a certain equity among all people, and abolish then the hierarchies of wealth and poverty, being the elite of society and the lowest, all of that is negated. And in Luther's understanding of the priesthood of all believers, once you say that, the implications should be immediate. Let me tell this story by, so nobody falls asleep after the work of today, by trying to set the image of Luther's inviting his friends to his house. An event that happened in the year 1529, 1 year before the Augsburg Confession was put before the Emperor Charles V in Augsburg, where the Lutherans fought for their identity. But before that time, Luther summoned his friends to his house. And let me try to just try to portray how Luther might have talked to his friends in that moment. People come into the house, if you've been there, you know, this big old wooden structure that Frederick the Wise gave to Martin and Katie on Katie's birthday. But this was a very, very nice place where they lived. So he said, "Well, friends," it was late in the day, about this time, he says, "Oh, guten Abend, herzlich willkommen, welcome to everybody. Katie and I, and the kids, Hans and Magdalena, are very happy to see you all on this day. And I have something very important to talk to you about." But first of all, he greeted them. He said, "Hello there, Philip Melanchthon," Luther's alter ego, the one who wrote the Confessio Augustana, young student, and his wife, Barbara. He welcomes them most cordially. And then he turns to his friends, Lukas Krampf. And he says, welcome to you, my friends. They were the elite, wealthy. Luther called him the Renaissance man of Wittenberg. He says, Lucas, my brother, you're not only the town mayor, the Lord Mayor of Wittenberg, he was also the printer. And the printing press just hadn't been invented. This was a big thing. Always in motion, day and night, the Cranach print, and if you go to Wittenberg today, you can stop by the Cranach Printing Company. But he says, listen, Lucas, you're also the great artist of the Reformation. And you know, if you go through the castle church, if you go through the city church, Church of St. Mary, right in the middle of town, there you see these great paintings of Lucas Cranach. Polemic, the good guys and the bad guys, yes. There was also a lot of controversy around these paintings. But they brought in loads of money. So that Cranach became one of the wealthier people. He greeted the young man, Georg von Grumbach. You know, they brought all these young men from all over, the Netherlands, from Bavaria, to study there in Wittenberg, and they lived with the Cranach family. They lived with the Luther and the Luther's house, Huld. They lived with the Melanchthon and their family as well. Because the revolution, certainly out in the West, was really carried by the young people. It was carried by these young people, and many of them at great personal cost. But Luther says, welcome friends, I have an important message to share. You know, Johannes, the Elector of Saxony, has asked me to travel throughout Saxony with Justin Jonas, another reformer, my friend, and we have visited the congregations where the word of the Reformation has taken root. And we've discovered a couple things. There's good news and bad news. And the first thing he said, the good news is that the word of the Reformation, spreading like a wildfire throughout Saxony, beyond, and into France, into Geneva, the East and the West, moving slowly into the North. And he says the bad news, he says that we found that pastors are a little bit lazy. We heard some sermons that would really make you want to throw up. That's in Luther's words. And he said, what are they doing? Aren't they really doing their homework? And he lashed out against these pastors of the evangelical movement. And he said, you know, I'm writing a little booklet that is really for fathers. And the pastors aren't going to do it. The fathers, they are primary teachers of their young students. They must teach the students about the Bible, about God's Word. And I'm preparing this book, I'm calling it The Small Catechism. And it should be ready in just a couple of months. That will help them. But then Luther got to the main point of his welcome. You know what we discovered in Saxony? And I hate to say this, friends, because it is so painful. We have found that there's a great deal of hunger. People do not have food to eat. Children go to bed hungry at night. How can this be? Read the scripture, read the prophets. This is Luther talking. And some of his words, you can't even translate them. He is so fit and angry about this. He says, how can you preach the gospel and then some people are hungry? Some people have nothing. He said, yes, I know, the plague is among us. The pest is among us. People are dying. But look, we have such tremendous amount of wealth. Why is this happening? Well, the first culprit is really the church, he said. We are to blame. He singled out this fellow, St. Francis. He says, this man down in Assisi, he is talking about poverty being next to godliness. Yes, I know he talks to the birds and the trees and everything, and he's a very nice chap, probably, but also very naive. How can you talk this way when you read the Holy Scripture? To say that being poor brings you being closer to God? He said, that's not what I read in the Bible. But he said, another problem with the church is this. Through the selling of indulgences, selling the forgiveness of sins, the church is accumulating vast wealth to build the great cathedrals of Rome. And that fellow, you remember him coming through the streets of Wittenberg, Johannes Tetzel, saying, what was he, what did he say? Somebody told me that earlier today.
Oh, as soon as the coin and the copper claims the soul from purgatory springs.
Oh, yes.
What was it?
As soon.
He said it in German. As soon as the coin and copper claims.
Das Geld in den Koffer klingt, der Seele aus dem Purgatory springt.
The soul springs from purgatory.
Yeah, well, and he was selling, of course, indulgences, raising money for the Archbishop of Mainz, going through town, and Luther says, listen, this not only undercuts the primary message of the church, the free gift of God's grace in Christ, which is free for everyone, not for sale, setting up this hierarchical order, but is also driving people further into poverty. But he reserved his harshest critique finally for this. He said, you know what is happening, friends? That in this new day, people are just accumulating wealth for profit. Starting with this slow revolution of entrepreneurs, bankers coming in, lending money, 20, 30, 40, 50% interest. Of course, if you've read the 95 Theses, you know that Luther's primary topic there was the economy. And this practice of ripping people off through this high percentage of interest. He says the Fugger Banking Company, they're getting rich, and some leaders of the church there are getting very wealthy as well. While people here are suffering. People in our kitchens, and he wrote a book about that. He wrote many tracts, of course, probably more than on any topic in the whole vast repertoire of Luther's works were written on the economy. But in this book, he wrote in the same year of this meeting, he called it the Large Catechism. And in this book, he wrote, among other things, the poor are defrauded every day. And new burdens and higher prices are imposed. They all use the market and misuse it in their own arbitrary, defiant, arrogant way, as if it were their right and privilege to sell their goods as high as they please without criticism. His basic critique came against the market economy of the day, run by partly the church, partly the Vatican, is why Luther had so much support among the German princes. Everybody was being taken for a ride. These people that are armchair bandits, highway robbers, far from being pickpockets and sneak thieves who pilfer the cash box, they sit on their chairs and are known as great lords and honorable upstanding citizens while they rob and steal under the cloak of legality. But, he said, also this is what we did in Wittenberg. In the face of all this, we sat down together with the town council, of course Frederick the Wise, his protector, and said, how can we create a system out of the initiative of the gospel that will treat all people equally? Well, they hired a carpenter to build a chest. And this is the original. You can see it still today. Pass that around. And they called it die gemeinsame Kasten, really the community chest. They asked four of the leaders of the city, representing each part of Wittenberg, to make an assessment once a month regarding people's ability to make a contribution. And pretty soon, people were making contributions. Lukas von Cranach, he did very well. Painting Soul, printing company, he contributed into this box once a month, a certain amount. Herr Schneider, whose family was sick, his wife had the plague, children were hungry, once a month he was given out of this chest enough so that he could live and he wouldn't have to beg. Begging was then disallowed by law. When Luther came to Wittenberg in 1509, there were beggars everywhere. Beggars everywhere. And part of them were the Franciscans, the Benedictines, people who were in the order of begging. It was thought to be good merits to contribute to the poor. It was thought if you were really poor, you were close to God. Well, after the reformers, including Martin Luther, first talked to the city council, begging was totally, there was be no need for begging. Money came in when the monasteries were sold, the cloisters were sold. People could come and take loans out. Students could come. They wouldn't have to pay for their education then. They developed a health care so that the doctors would be really city doctors and would go and visit the people and charge nothing. It became unbelievably popular throughout Wittenberg. The next year, in the town of Leisnig, little town, the town council came to Luther and said, would you write an order for us And now if you go to Luther's works, you can go to the Leisnig order. There they had 12 people who oversaw. You know, the big suitcase had three locks on it. That's all that equipment there, those three locks, so that you could not, it's like signing three names on a check, I suppose. Make sure that, and if you were a pastor, you weren't allowed to participate in that at all. But they had lay people from the city, respected people who had the key to open those locks. Once a month, collection, once a month, a distribution. And if you go to Wittenberg today, in the basement of the town church of Bugenhagen's church, there you can see all the records, written records, who gave, how much, every to the penny, very German like in their order. And then he asked these people, he says, friends, now I know what some of you are thinking, he says, this sounds like some new law. Here we have the freedom of the gospel. Now you're talking about being in some system. Is this what the... And he says, no. Nein. From the gospel, you cannot... And from the Bible, you cannot have any particular social, economic, political system that's demanded. Absolutely not. He says, but in our freedom, God has given us the reason. God has given us this sense of faith active in love so that we are free now. And he made that famous quote about the Christian is the freest person of all, subject to none. But the Christian is the most dutiful servant, subject to everyone. That is, we are freed up by the gospel of Christ and then constrained by God's love to share the wealth of the earth with all of God's people. It went from Leisnig to Danzig to Strasbourg to Nuremberg. It started sweeping the entire country. Bugenhagen and his friends took it to Scandinavia. And although this was all interrupted by the wars that followed, picked up later and became the basis of the economic systems that prevail in Western Europe and in Scandinavia today. They are based on Martin Luther's reform. He says, this is not what the church is called to do. We are called to proclaim the gospel. This is what God calls the state to do. This is why these reforms were enacted by the political leaders. Church people, the reformers, they have all the suggestions, put them all in the book, but it wasn't. And as you know, in the Reformation, there was to be no pastor taking a political office. This is what they were fighting against, actually, in the Church of Rome. And but this was something in the freedom. But this was God calls the state under God, not the autonomous state, but this is God's calling of the state to keep the peace, keep good order, and to make sure the well-being of every single person is guaranteed. The church has to remind the state of what its task is. So, yeah?
I'm not quite following you because you said that Luther said that if we're following God's word through the scriptures, we give freely. But if it's a state-based system, we're not giving freely. We don't have a choice. And I'm beginning to sound like I'm very politically conservative here, which I am not, but that would, I think, be the argument.
Well, the task of the church, and of course Luther cites the prophets of the Old Testament too, they are arguing in front of the political leaders, calling for justice. And he says, anybody who follows Christ must call for the equal sharing of God's world with all people. Now, how that translates into political dynamics or economic realities, that is up for the people to decide. And Luther said, well, use your reason. Think about it. But think about it in love towards your neighbor. So it wasn't the task of the reformers to make those political economic decisions, but to establish the basis. He says the task of a pastor from the pulpit is to proclaim God's judgment against those people who are ripping us off in the world. You are to take the masks away from these people who are exploiting the poor in our day and call it by its name. That was about as political as he would get. Now, you have to ask yourself, what type of system would then best guarantee that the wealth of God's creation would be shared with equity? That's what you have to figure out. Last year, a couple of congregations got together in Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia, and we started to argue, debate all of these issues. We had economists there from the World Bank. We had lay people who worked for the government, and it was fantastic. And this took us about 6 months, and then we had a big symposium in November 2015 in Washington, D.C. 2 days, about 150 people were there, but it was very intense. We called it the Forgotten Luther, recovering the social economic dimension of the Reformation. Because, let's face it, the questions are as relevant today as they were in Luther's time. Out of that, by the way, came a little book, if anybody's interested. It's called The Forgotten Luther. I'm not here to sell these books, but it's just only a couple of weeks off the press, Lutheran University Press, and I was happy to see that the unit on world hunger of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America has taken this and now is going to make the study available to congregations throughout the church.
How can congregations get that study?
Well, it's online. You can go to the Facebook page. You can, or you could sign your name on a list here and give me $20, and I'd send you a copy next week.
Okay.
And but take a look at it. Some of the top theologians of the Lutheran Church are writing on this. Maybe you've read Carter Lindbergh's historic studies on Luther and the poor at Boston University. Cynthia Libido out at Berkeley. We have Samuel Torvent at Pacific Lutheran University. John Paul at Philadelphia Seminary. Tim Huffman, a leader of the missions of the church at Trinity Seminary, contributing to this. And my friends and I have just done the editorial work, although a lot of work. We hope at least that it will start a discussion on one area that, frankly, of Luther, that you don't learn in college or seminary. How many pastors have learned it? I mean, I spent 4 years at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. I never heard about this. You know? But it is sweeping. And when it was picked up again, the so-called welfare state, if you will, it is an amazing thing to behold. And it owes its origin to Martin Luther. You know what, when this is, I'm not making a case for the Western European economic style of Scandinavia, but when I went to school at the University of Berlin, you know, 5 years, at the University of Berlin, I figure the whole thing, 5 years, cost me, my family, maybe $200. That's 5 years of education. This is the common chest. When we were in Berlin, our son had a bad accident on a horse. He broke his leg. It was a terrible, horrible thing. Surgery after surgery and surgery in Germany with the Swiss method, and then in England. But he went on to be really strong. He set records in track. That whole thing, medications, operations, everything, cost us absolutely zero. And it would cost you the same today if that happened to you, if you were in one of these countries. Luther said, everyone pays for health care. Everybody contributes to health. Some can afford it, some can't. We have to make sure that everybody is treated with dignity as a child of God. When you go to Scandinavia today, of course, if you have a bad accident, something happens to you there, you don't worry about your medical bills. That's one thing you won't have to, I mean, it's crazy expensive to buy food in the restaurant, but if something happens, you know, you won't have it. You know, I encourage young people here to go to university in France, or in Italy, in Scotland, in English language. I say, man, don't go getting this huge debt in the United States. Go to one of these countries, get your degree, bachelor's degree, doctorate degree. Cost you maybe a few $100. Social Security? Don't worry about it. You go to one of these countries, Portugal, if you go to any of these countries, your Social Security is really guaranteed. Should have no anxiety about that. It all comes out of something that happened at the time of the Reformation. Of course, oversimplified, because it went through all kinds of changes and so forth. But it said this: understanding of God's grace for all people means that we share the wealth of God's creation with equity, at least so that nobody is left out. Nobody has to be hungry at night. We are trying, and the World Hunger Unit of the ELCA is trying, to get people to ask, why are people hungry in the U.S.? Part of our study of last year in the Washington, D.C. area was with people who are hungry, people who don't have enough, who maybe have jobs where they have minimal wage, barely live from day to day. It's terrible. Why does it, and of course the other half, you know, the celebrated 1%, I mean, more and more tax breaks, and you've got this vast discrepancy between the very rich and the very poor in the United States. I mean, you have it in the world too, in other countries. But, and no country's ideal. They're all problems along the way, but healthcare, education, social security, access to the arts, to the opera. You know, that has to be available for all people. And although I'm not making a case for any particular country, I think that we have something to learn. And if you've seen the downside of this, as I certainly have in my ministry as a Lutheran pastor, then you agonize with those people who are come out on the short end and have some disdain for the people who only accumulate vast amounts of money for themselves. But are there questions? Have you heard this about Martin Luther? I haven't either. Thank you.
In Luther's time, were the these economic entities citywide or countrywide?
I don't know. I think that there were both. I mean, Germany was divided into these princedoms, you know, so that they were the estates. And they were all the estates of the Holy Roman Empire. As well, and part of the problem, the estates paid so much tax to Rome, to Charles V, the emperor, to the Pope, and they didn't like that. You know, that was one of the dynamics. But and basically, it was the prince, like in the Philip of Hesse, in the estate next to Saxony, Philip instituted Luther's reforms. Now there you have the documentation there, and you see what a sweeping effect it had throughout Hesse in that state. Some were a little bit more reluctant, and for different reasons. Plus you had the Muslims playing a role there trying to be a wedge between Luther and the Pope for the wrong reasons, and people were a little bit reluctant there because you had Suleiman the Magnificent storming the gates of Vienna, calling on Martin Luther to say, come on, Martin, you and I could work together against the Habsburgs, against the Pope, against Charles V. And so there were a lot of political things in the mix there. But where it began was in the towns. In the towns. In Saxony, of course, it began in Wittenberg. And then Leipzig became the star example. And then Leipzig, a little further to the south. And then Danzig. And then Strasbourg, right over near France. And it started getting ideas in the head of John Calvin also. For the Reformed tradition, and even down in the Swiss, Heinrich Zwingli, the father of the sort of Reformed of Switzerland, he liked what Luther was saying about the economy. These are no new laws. Yeah.
Observation, I mean, it sounds like the common box taught on in Europe, and it's the spirit of Europe's system of helping others. How did this not come across the Atlantic to the United States?
Yeah.
Well, I think it did.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I just read an article about that here recently, and I have it on my laptop, which is I left home because this is Holden Village, but where it's a paper on this dynamic, how it wasn't the Lutheran but the Calvinist influence that came with the British. If you've read The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, that classic book, it tells the story of how this understanding of being on the elect of God became capitalized, so to say, so that people began to understand being part of the elect as having more wealth and more money. So the whole understanding of being wealthy and being actually morally superior for that reason was a major thing that came with some of the Puritans from Great Britain took over, and the British understanding of the laissez-faire, leave us alone, no regulation society, just the opposite. Luther called for regulation. Prince Philip the Wise called for regulation. But then Adam Smith and that whole understanding of just leave it alone, capitalism took hold of, and of course it became very popular because if you did make a lot of money, then you wanted to entrench those structures by which you got there and by which you could keep the money. I mean, the forces of equity only fought against this. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the New Deal, all of these movements, of course. And of course, earlier in the labor movement in the United States, if you know that story or part of that story, you know that there was a struggle by people to say we have to have rights for all people, for workers. But then people say, well, no, that's communism. We can't have that. And it became a big conflict in this country. And even today, in the political elections, you know, Bernie Sanders, of course, to be honest, represents what Luther stood for, all right down the line. He's maybe no longer, but it shows how very hard it is. I mean, he may have had negotiations with Hillary Clinton to get some of his policies as planks in the Democratic platform, but Bernie Sanders is the closest we've come to anything that Luther was thinking, if you just ask my opinion about it. If you read the book The Great Divide, and books that are coming out, it shows what is now happening to American society as it pulls further and further apart, wealth-wise. We had movements in the U.S., in the Midwest, that were sort of agrarian socialism, you call them, the cooperative movements of North Dakota, South Dakota, Saskatchewan, and Canada, and these were movements to try to equalize a bit the wealth without taking away individual freedom and so forth. People yell out every time it happens. I mean, it's like Dom Helder Camara said, every time I give food to the hungry, people call me a saint. But when I ask why are the people hungry, why are the people hungry, they call me a communist. And that is, of course, the tragedy of what has actually happened for the great leaders of South America, Central America, Archbishop Romero, Catholic leaders of the movement for preferential option for the poor. You know, in Guatemala, El Salvador, these places, these lay catechists, of course, were killed, massacred by the hundreds in these countries. And in Brazil, Honduras. It continues to be a huge, huge struggle.
I'm having difficulty getting from Martin Luther to Bernie Sanders for one reason, in that Martin Luther wasn't in a democracy. The whole institution of government was so radically different from the institution of government that we experience. And so I want to be clear in my understanding of what you're saying. Who was Luther talking to? Was he talking to the state, in other words, the nobility, or was he somehow prescient that there would someday be a democracy, that it would be the responsibility of us all?
Well, let me make no allusion to the fact that these situations are so non-comparable. The situations in with Luther and today, I mean, they're totally, totally different.
Okay.
What is the same? Is the call for justice, not for any particular system, but you call on the church, first of all, the first word of the church for Luther is the word against the church. First you assess what is the sin in your own midst. Then you start talking about the sin out there. And as Luther, of course, the Reformation itself was a critique against injustice within the church. But then beyond that, injustice within the world. What Luther called the liturgy after the liturgy. He says, friends, this is just an extension of the liturgy of the divine worship service. When you leave that church, it moves into the liturgy, liturgia, nach der liturgia. And this is how you serve your neighbor. How you work that out, different political systems, economic, it's tough. But one thing is constant. All people are created in God's image, are people of dignity, people who are given God's grace in Jesus Christ. Yep.
So, Luther, Jesus, Buddha, they're all operating within a system of agriculture.
Within?
A system of agriculture, that we could develop a surplus that would extract us from an immediate dependency on nature. I think we're the first species in the history of the planet, in its billions of years of existence, to try the experiment of gathering our food independent of a direct relationship with nature. And in that, in extracting it from ourselves from that, we've ended up with these issues of redistribution, which go back way before Luther. And you have Jesus at the bottom of the system, who comes in and says, you know, give it all away. Follow me, give it all away and wander. And you've got Buddha at the top of the system, a prince who says, you know, go and beg every day for your food. That there's something else. It's almost as if they're saying this system is the problem when we extract ourselves. I like what you said at the beginning of seeing through the thing. But I like you talk about the common chest. We're so in this system of agriculture, I hardly ever hear anyone talking about how recent these last 10,000 years this is compared to 100, 200,000 years before of a direct relationship. So I think about that a lot. And I don't really know how to plot.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for that. I have to think, really think about that a little bit more. You know, some of these insights, I think, into the equality of humanity, you know, shared among a number of different faith traditions. And we have to listen to each other. But certainly, Jesus began a community, unleashed a community in which people shared what they had. They had everything in common. Okay, that doesn't mean you have to absolutize that particular system. That was the way they understood what it meant to love God, serve one's neighbor. And we have to develop our own way. And sometimes other faith traditions, you know, can help us. I've been working in northern Nigeria for the last few years with Muslims in a very difficult area. But there I discovered some interesting things about Muslims and about the Prophet Muhammad. You know, who totally revered Jesus and the Virgin Mary. And partly, of course, because Jesus called on people to share what they had. And Muhammad says, I'm trying to follow his example. And when you see that happen in these towns of northern Nigeria, you have to stop and take a step back a little bit. And I take my hat off to the young groups of Christian and Muslim young people who are trying to implement these policies in the villages where they've had massacre and where Boko Haram and other terrorist groups are functioning. So to listen to this, I mean, this is beyond me, what you have said, but I really have to think about that.
Yes. Well, pertinent to that, the Joseph in Egypt story relates to that because the famine is coming, so we'll have years of plenty, so we'll put away. That seems to say something about the common chest of food.
That's good.
Of course, that is agriculture, organized agriculture. Isn't that?
Well, just another word. I mean, the Garden of Eden. If you look at that as the transition, there's a pretty significant curse to the beginning of agriculture. And then if you read through Exodus and you know, depending on manna, God apparently, from the scriptures, really likes that. Go and be dependent daily again for 40 days and see if you can get that lesson. And then now let's go for the milk and honey.
Milk and honey. You know, that's interesting. That's what Prophet Muhammad said when all of his people were being killed and annihilated. He said, I'm going to send my people to be with the Christians because they know something about sharing. So he sent all of his followers across the Red Sea down into Abyssinia. There they were received by King Negus in Abyssinia, cared for how many years, 30, 40, and then sent back. And Muhammad says, thank you, Christians. We will always be together with the people of the book, that is the Jews, and the Christians. We will honor you, respect you, and we will make sure that no harm comes to you. So that was just a little footnote where you suddenly realize that, and you know, you go to Ethiopia today and they have these ceremonies. Of course, it's a terrible dictatorial government, but the church has these ceremonies of sharing. And they're trying to get back a sort of a sharing with Muslims now. It's very difficult because all of the Muslims have come down into Ethiopia. But there, the Lutherans, of course, because they have shared, I mean, look what's happening to them. I was there when the Makani Yezu Church started, 40,000 people. Now it's almost 8 million people. Largest Lutheran church of the world. Well, next to the Indonesians. But the Lutherans there? Why? Because they said this is the whole gospel for the whole person. That is their word. And so we're going to live up to that. And so people in these little villages out dying of poverty, starvation, suddenly had something to eat. I can't pin that on Luther, but certainly on Jesus. You know, this is what it's called of us. And how we structure it, how we form it, that's, we got to work that out. And as Martin Luther said, better a wise Muslim than a dumb Christian, you know, in charge of your government. He said, better a wise Turk. But I mean, you could translate Turk as a Muslim, because it's actually the same. And this is why Martin Luther translated the Quran, and he saw, could the Spirit of God be also working in these people too? We don't really talk about that too much. You know, all the stories of Islam, they come out of Genesis. They come out of Abraham. You know, they come out of Ishmael, the founder of the Muslim people. But we don't read those stories. Synagogue doesn't either. They just pass over like we do in church. But we shouldn't. We got to read those stories again, because Abraham loved Ishmael, his firstborn son. He loved him, even if Sarah had second thought. You know, we got to read those stories again and maybe understand our Muslim brothers and sisters a little bit better. Thank you for this.
Thank you.